Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Shulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we are back for a fairly regularly scheduled episode. We have no guests. It's just the three of us. There are no men. It's kind of back to business as usual. So welcome to 2020, ladies.
Guys, it's February.
Yeah, and the last week lasted a month. After a January that wouldn't end, the first week of February was like, I got this. It's been rough.
Like, I guarantee that if we just quizzed one of you, you would have forgotten one of the things that happened this week.
That's
one
right.
of the, like, ginormous things that happened this week.
Look, margin of error, plus minus 3%.
I've already forgotten that the State of the Union was this week.
Oh,
so,
my God. I mean, it's...
Well, what do you say first? What are we drinking?
I am drinking fresh coffee that my husband implores me to say is in a disappearing Bill of Rights coffee mug.
Thank you, Ross, for providing Lauren with coffee not from the microwave.
I'm drinking slightly less fresh coffee. It's not from the microwave. It is lukewarm, and it was made an indeterminate number of hours ago. But helpfully, it is in a now panic and freak out with an upside down crown mug.
I really like that, and I think we all may need some of those.
Yeah.
I'm drinking my second round of coffee and some fancy fizzy water that I've become addicted to from Whole Foods. So,
oh my God, that lime and elderflower stuff. It's amazing.
It's really good. And it's so good.
I still talk about it. I drank it once at Aaron's house. And I'm like, guys, this is amazing.
Well, before we slide into all the crazy things happening in the world this week, how about we kick off a new round of bombshell questions?
New questions.
Absolutely.
These are going to be fun, although I got to admit, it's going to be hard to top last year's. I really loved last year's questions, and I think they were kind of like perfect peak bombshell. So, but we have new ones for us all to answer, and we can all kind of take turns here. Let's start with the first question. What skill would you like to have that you currently don't?
Okay, guys. So mine is knitting, which many people are probably thinking, Radha, you could just learn to knit, and I have tried. And the thing is, I'm super uptight, so I can learn to knit and not drop any stitches, but I'm super uptight. So as I do it, I pull the knitting tighter and tighter until eventually my scarf looks like a narrow, skinny thing that's vaguely elastic, even though it's only made out of yarn. And so I don't knit. And I'm like jabbing the knitting needles in that like knives. It's just like, it's cool, guys. But I love the idea of knitting.
So I want to be able to like build houses and extensions on my own home and things like that and architecture. And I'm extremely worried that this latent desire was from an early teenhood read of an Ayn Rand novel. And I'm just going to pray that that is not actually the case. And that it's more like I saw the founding fathers who were, you know, Thomas Jefferson was also all about architecture. So it's maybe just me wanting to be like a well-rounded person and not being a crazy Randian.
Fair. I would love to be able to do anything around my own home and or hang my own pictures. But the skill that I think would actually be most useful for me is to be able to sew, because I have to hem every pair of pants and take up every jacket sleeve. And if I could just do that myself, I would feel so much more in control of my own life. And you know how I love that feeling. So here we are with our domestic skills. I mean, none of us want to, I guess we could fly. That's not really a skill. That's like a superpower.
Yeah.
We're all trying to be more useful in the zombie apocalypse, I think is what we're doing here. Because right now, not a lot of NFC processes for us to manage in the zombie apocalypse. So we're going to be...
Guys, we don't need zombies for an apocalypse at this point.
But this is where, Erin, this is where you're wrong. Like, they are up front not going to think they need organization as a skill in the zombie apocalypse. But later on, they'd be like, you know, if only we had listened to Erin, we would be so much better off right now.
6 months ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. What is a place you would like to visit before it is destroyed by climate change? I'll go first. I would like, this is sort of, you know, on the cusp. I'd like to go to Antarctica, but I might have to go like next week. So that's something that probably has to happen in the near term. A little more broadly, and this is also probably kind of on the cusp. I'd love to go back and spend some time in Glacier National Park, which is among my favorites and has just the most gorgeous purple and turquoise and gray color palette. Like, it's so different from Tetons or Yellowstone. But that color palette comes from the glacial chalk. And if the glaciers are gone, there's a little bit less to make it all so sparkly turquoise and pretty. So those are my two.
I would either like to go to one of the islands off of Portugal, like Madeira, which it's going to be a while until climate change changes it irrevocably, but like just the overall climate and the plants they produce and the feel of the island is going to change pretty dramatically over the long term. With the other option being, I've never been to Australia. I would like to go when it's not burning down. That doesn't seem like it's going to be an option in the near future.
Mine is the Galapagos. I've long wanted to go. Like the animals, the sort of writing and how it's changed and how the animals are different seems super interesting. It's definitely going to be destroyed by the climate change. And Antarctica, which I think might already kind of be destroyed. Like it's like 65 degrees there. So, you know.
Got to get on this trip planning. Yeah. I mean, this is what we're all saying here. This is all a little rough. Okay, who's got the next question?
No, I'll ask. What book, Radha, do you want to live in all the time?
So I thought this one was relatively hard because most of the books I like to read, it's not actually great to be a woman in them.
Like I assume you'd pick a Jane Austen book or something.
Yeah, but like, I mean, entailment, you don't want to live. I want to own property, lady. I love owning property. So anyway, what I was thinking was that I would want to be a queen in a Philippa Gregory-esque novel. So I could be in charge, sort of dealing with the political machinations, also running my own council and internal processes, while at the same time wearing fabulous dresses and crowns and tiaras as I see fit.
I have not done a great deal of self-examination on this, but just since I was about 10 years old, I've wanted to live in the book Farmer Boy by Laura Ingalls Wilder because they just eat so well in that book. I haven't thought about the gender dynamics or what I'd have to do to like, you know, raise things on a farm. I just, they eat like 10 kinds of pie in every meal. And who doesn't want that?
I can't believe Wolf Hall wasn't your answer.
Yeah, again, women's lives suck in that. So
I mean, I guess we have it, you know, yes, that's true. Are there any female characters really at all? Well, just the wives who all die get beheaded, I guess.
Yeah.
So
yeah, more or less.
Not all of them get beheaded.
So mine is sort of a cheat, but I would like to live in Cloud Atlas, the David Mitchell novel. And because I get bored easily, I could then be like one of the souls that gets to migrate through all of the different worlds. And you could kind of bop around between the, you know, 19th century composer and the 25th century Korea and all the things in between. So I just sort of love each of the little worlds that are created in Cloud Atlas, the movie notwithstanding. So that's kind of my halfway house.
Okay, so what if we had a robot staff to add to our household? What would you want it to do?
So mine's really lame. Like, I just want a robot to change my sheets. I hate changing the sheets. I always have to do it by myself. Like, the sheets actually currently do not all fit in my washing machine at one time, which is like insult to injury. So I would just like there to be a robot who somehow manages to put fresh, clean sheets on my bed at like a highly frequent interval.
Mine is also somewhat lame, which is I want a robot to follow my children around and wipe their hands and faces with some kind of antibacterial wipe and then maybe spray some disinfectant behind them in the trail of germs and grossness they leave. And then I will play with regularly clean and sanitized children. It sounds great. I mean, I love my kids and they're super cute, but they are so gross, guys.
These questions really are great lenses into our personalities. I would like, so some people don't know that when you are pregnant and often after you have been pregnant before, you acquire like a superhuman smelling capability.
Yes.
You get to smell things really radically differently than other people. I still maintain this. And therefore, I would like a robot that whenever I say, what is that smell? First of all, takes care of the smell and makes sure that it never returns ever again.
I think that'd be amazing. That's like a great like neural net learning algorithm plus industrial grade bug bomb combo. I kind of dig
it.
Yeah.
It's great.
Great. Well, those are the new bombshell questions.
Should we just stop here and not deal with the... No.
I was going to say, do we feel ready to discuss the 16 ways the world is falling apart?
And let's be clear. We're not talking about impeachment at all. Like, we already have so many other things that are going to ruin our world.
The caucuses. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, cool. Exactly. So let's start with just the minor things of global pandemic.
Sure,
how are we all
great.
Feeling about the coronavirus?
I mean, I go back and forth on this. In the we should not. Jeremy Conendick, who was he worked in the Obama administration in a variety of capacities. He had a piece out this week that basically saying we should not be panicking in a please go, oh, do embrace security theater version of pandemic preparedness, but instead should be making sure that all of our hospitals and frontline health workers in the United States and elsewhere have everything they need just in case this gets bad. And that feels like a comforting level of don't panic that direction, but panic in this other direction, like middle ground that I feel good about.
So just in terms of like the basics, I think we're recording here on Sunday, February 9th. We're at around 37,000 cases in China with nearly 900 deaths. So as a fatality rate, that's not super fatal. On the other hand, that's basically occurred within 2 months, and it's higher than the level of SARS deaths from 2002 and 2003, which took the better part of a year to accumulate. So it seems like this is all still pretty early, like we don't have great details on the pathology just yet, but that the virus is highly transmittable, if not especially fatal. And so that's part of what folks are trying to manage. I think now there are reports of cases in 24 countries, although only one case, I think, in the United States itself. Is that right, Radha?
No, there are more cases in the United States, I think almost up to 10 identified cases, but most aren't serious. And so only a few have required hospitalization. There's, I think, only been one death outside of China. And I think one sort of big issue and looming question for the global health community is that this has started in China, and a lot of the initial reporting, data, testing, pathology all has to come from data sharing from the Chinese government. And there are actually quite a lot of concerns about the reliability of the information being provided, reliability about the transmission mechanisms. There was just a recent report about the initial spread taking place within the hospital, but not from hospital procedures, which is a more common way intra-hospital spreads happen, which is like you use a tool, it's not properly disinfected, but rather from infection of health workers, which, if that's the case, suggests a very highly contagious illness in a way that wasn't previously understood. So I think there are a lot of open questions like that are not just hard because we don't know the answer, but because we're not sure how good the data from China actually is.
One thing that I think as we're studying about this lack of trust in China's reporting and data and management of this crisis is that as a result, a lot of the security and screening procedures are very much focused on exclusively on China. In the last week, Russia, Singapore, Australia have sealed their borders to China. Many other countries have dramatically escalated their own response to people who are traveling from China, quarantining them or just banning them outright. But what that doesn't take care of is two factors. One, that because the virus has spread to other countries, they are not receiving the same kind of screening like from Singapore or others who have come from China. And then two, because we are dramatically, like in some ways, overdoing our response to China on this, other countries may be less likely to want to report any of their own instances of the virus because they'll be worried about a similar impact on their travel and economy and in the way that like China has faced a lot of repercussions in this space.
Oh, that's a good point. I mean, there's this broader question as you were talking about transmissibility and fatality rates that assumes that we have good information on either of those things. And that's part of the challenge with the pathology. There's also then the U.S. response. We would normally hold this for sort of White House mayhem, but that section's a little crowded this week. So the U.S. has imposed a quarantine, which I have to say is one of my favorite words because it's based off the number of days that ships had to sit in port in Venice during the Black Death before they were allowed in. Anyway, the U.S. has imposed a quarantine on people traveling from China for the first time, I guess, since like the 1960s when there were smallpox quarantines. So we have a number of planes that basically were allowed to land at U.S. military installations, including like State Department personnel who are now in a 14-day quarantine while they, we think is incubation period for the virus. So there's the U.S. policy here is sort of complex. And my understanding is that both CDC and the World Health Organization don't tend to think that quarantines and travel bans are particularly effective ways of containing the spread. Basically, unless you can shut down everything, it doesn't do as what they want it to do. But it, as you say, Lauren, has political appeal or implications. And, you know, that's kind of the stage management that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, the things that they have not done, interestingly, yet are ask for any sort of emergency supplemental funding to address this a possible health crisis in the United States. At the same time, over the last several years, the Trump administration has slashed pandemic disease funding at the CDC, has eliminated some of the White House positions that were dedicated to managing pandemics of all kinds, and have just, as a rule, been, I think, attempting to get people to not panic, but they haven't leaned over into that like preparedness panic that I would want them to do at this stage.
All right. Anything else on the joyous developments of the coronavirus? Well, let's go back to one of our favorite topics. Radha, do you want to bring us up to speed a little bit on Brexit? It happened.
It did. So, and you may remember in one of our discussions of what do we wish we would talk about less, this was mine. I was just like, let's get this over with. And so, you know, here we are-ish. So it happened. We're now in the transition or implementation period, which will go until December 2020. So we've got, you know, 11 months here to figure out mostly all of the rules and trade agreements. So during this period, all of the rules and trade agreements are going to remain the same as they were as if Britain were in the EU still. But at the end, Britain will need to decide on trade policy and customs union. And that means sort of like, what is the trading agreement between the EU and the UK? Folks may remember this was a big sticking point with the question of the quote unquote backstop. That is there going to be a hard border either between Northern Ireland and the rest of Great Britain or between the United Kingdom, including Northern Ireland, and the Republic of Ireland, that is a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic on the island of Ireland. And that remains an open question with interesting implications. But there are just like a whole mess of other agreements that need to get sorted out. So like law enforcement, information sharing, aviation rules, energy policy, high tech rules. So there's a lot of work to be done. It's not totally clear what's going to happen, but it's either going to happen or it's not. And at the end of the time period, the UK will have the rules it has and not have the rules it doesn't have. And we will all live to see what that is like. So, you know, it's going to be fine.
They could still essentially crash out of the European Union.
Correct.
Which was like kind of the sort of Damocles that hung over all of the discussions last year. But they actually have to negotiate some set of these rules and tariff applications. And if they don't, they'll revert back to WTO GATT rules, essentially on tariffs?
Correct. And those will only cover goods that were in existence at the time prior to the EU. So you can imagine the entire high-tech sector and a lot of things that are
services
covered
as well.
Yeah, exactly. Are not covered under that because there weren't issues at the time.
So by point of reference, one of the articles I read talked about that the negotiations between the UK and Canada for a free trade agreement took 5 years.
I think an interesting question will be how much the UK ends up kind of trying to build rules and efforts to minimize sort of barriers and trade with Europe versus how much it turns towards like old colonial partners / the Commonwealth or the US. And obviously there is an inflection point here and there are interesting choices the British government can make. And so that will have implications for them, for the world economy, for US-UK relations. So there's interesting stuff to come, but I just want to just be clear. We're done with Brexit. They've Brexited, guys. Brexited. Past tense.
But as you know, it has some other political implications, one of which is in the Republic of Ireland and potentially for the island of Ireland, as you noted. So we're recording again on Sunday and we are waiting for results of the Irish elections, which will take several days, not because they're incompetent like the State Party of Iowa, but because they use single transferable vote, which I remembered as I was prepping for this podcast today. So I was like, oh yeah, that's right. It's amazing. We're not going to explain that to you, but you can Google it. It's very interesting. But also interesting from the exit results, I don't know if you guys had a chance to look at any of these. There's basically a three-way tie amongst the parties in Ireland right now. I am not good at pronouncing Gaelic words, despite the fact that my name is Erin. So we're not going to...
Yeah, so it's Sinn Féin, Fine Gael, and Fianna Fáil. And they all essentially have 22%, I would note, with a margin of error of 1.3%. So there is some chance actually somebody ends up with a significant lead. Guys, I'm on a margin of error kick. I'm just going to all the time say it. But it's most relevant here because Sinn Féin, who was a party that was had association with the IRA in the past, the
but
other
it's
two
always
parties.
Had a different engagement in the South, right? I mean, is it? Right. Yeah.
And it is sort of the left-wing party, in theory. They fielded candidates in fewer locations. So even with a tie, it means that they will have fewer sort of members in the parliament. And that has implications for sort of what the needs are for a coalition government. So the key here is with the single transferable vote, the second choice party votes get distributed among the winners above a certain threshold. And so what we're waiting to see is the total number of vote count. No one's going to end up with enough to not have a coalition government. The two other major parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, have not gone into coalition with each other before ever, but have always said that they would not form a coalition with Sinn Féin. So now there's kind of a question of, would they form a coalition together and just kind of like split ministerial posts? Would they try to get a smaller party on board? And I think that's kind of what's open here.
And so two things of that are interesting a little bit more broadly. One, the two centrist parties, Fianna Fáil and
Fine Gael.
Fine Gael have basically been in power in Ireland since independence. So basically for 100 years, these two parties have alternated power. So that there's any party getting as many votes essentially in the vote count or in the percentage votes as them is a pretty big seismic shift in Irish politics. The second is that, you know, as we kind of go back to that Brexit conversation, you know, depending on how the backstop is implemented in Brexit, you know, if you basically have the Northern Ireland counties, you know, essentially still in customs union with Southern counties, right, with the Republic of Ireland,
right.
This is the main plank of Sinn Féin historically, which is a unified Republican Ireland, right? Republican meaning not part of the monarchy. So the Sinn Féin candidates this time around were actually campaigning on much more bread and butter issues, particularly, I think, housing affordability and healthcare type questions. But the particular political moment put Sinn Féin in a very interesting position, given the opportunities for further integration on the island of Ireland and a potential unification platform there. So a lot to watch and kind of interesting dynamics, especially given the role that Ireland played in insisting on the backstop and their kind of role in the EU politics as well. So,
and just one final note, you know, we've had these conversations on sort of extremist parties. We typically talk about right-wing extremist parties. In this case, a lot of the discussion was on more traditional left-wing issues with this sort of outstanding question of IRA slash extra governmental actions to support reunification. And so it'll be interesting kind of to see Sinn Féin, regardless of how the coalition government works out, how they kind of thread that needle there of pushing for unification, which has long been a key platform in the context of trying to become a more legitimate political party.
All right. Shall we sort of slide into White House mayhem with a bridging topic?
Yeah, I think we fixed the Middle East, right, Lauren? Totally?
Yes. Was that your bridging topic?
That is. And Jared Kushner has just unveiled his, you know, long-awaited Middle East peace plan. And oh my goodness.
With a map.
Well, and that's actually a big deal. No one's ever had, well, I mean, we've had maps. We just didn't talk about them. So let's set the scene on this a little bit. President Trump, at the time this was released, had some impeachment things going on. Prime Minister Netanyahu was in the midst of and is still in the midst of corruption charges. The negotiating parties, the United States, had not talked to the Palestinians about this peace plan for something like 2 years and somehow expected them to be cool with the plan after closing the U.S. diplomatic mission there and severing financial ties and recognizing various settlements. So things were going great before we released the plan of the century and so forth. So that was this is my scene setter for what I'm sure was a great, great plan. Was it a great plan?
So,
I mean, I guess it depends on your perspective. If you like the idea of a contiguous Palestinian state,
you're not going to like this plan. Yeah.
If you like the idea of Arab-Israeli citizens maintaining their Israeli citizenship, no.
Probably not. That's the most surprising part to me, to be honest. We can come back to that. But right. Yeah, that's not a winner. If you want the Palestinians to have a capital in anything that actually resembles Jerusalem, not so much. If you're into Israeli settlements and extensions of Israeli sovereignty into the West Bank, you are bang on thrilled.
You are. This is the best thing ever. And it is those two things that will probably live on, unfortunately, after this plan, given the United States recognition of settlements, as well as their effective endorsement of Israel co-opting the Jordan River Valley.
Yeah, so there was actually quite a bit of debate, and maybe you guys followed this as well. When the plan got rolled out, there had been meetings with some of the Gulf Arab states as well, and they had kind of provisionally supported it, I think Qatar in particular. But my understanding is that they did not see the full details of the plan, and most of the states walked back that support once the full thing was revealed. Is that part of what happened?
Yeah, there were several provisional supports and then walking back of support. I don't think it's fair to say that the entire Arab world fundamentally hates every aspect of this plan. There are some, for I would say, political reasons with some ties in and interest in maintaining support for Jared Kushner himself. But no, I don't think anyone outside of maybe Benjamin Netanyahu and others are really, really excited about this plan.
And in particular, I mean, there is a broader kind of realignment. We've talked about this between Saudi Arabia and Israel, and they maybe would be more inclined to at least stay on the sidelines as opposed to actively oppose this. Of course, many Arab states have used the Palestinian, you know, cause and condition as a cudgel to, you know, beat up on Israel while doing very little themselves to advance the welfare of Palestinians or to offer them citizenship or residency in their own country. So it's quite a complicated situation there, as these things always are. But it's I think easy to forget what a dramatic shift this is in American policy, both in terms of pursuit of a two-state solution, which is probably best enshrined in the Oslo Accords, which Bill Clinton helped toward the end of that process, but also the recognition of what amount to illegal Israeli settlements, in particular in the West Bank, and allowing Israel to annex them and extend Israeli sovereignty. That's a huge shift. And, you know, these are not like recent policies. These are sort of long-standing challenges between the U.S. and the Israeli governments. But we've kind of just papered right over those. And I agree with you, Lauren. I don't know how you walk that back. I mean, that's literally the Israeli policy of creating facts on the ground. This will be the kind of, I don't know, ceiling of all of that, and will be quite difficult to undo.
And the foundation for all of this, which we should all recall anytime we have a moment of imposter syndrome, is that Jared Kushner read 25 books on the Middle East peace process, and therefore he feels really confident with this. So read 25 books on something. It's like the new Malcolm Gladwell measurement. You will be 100% capable of launching a disastrous plan of some kind and do so with the confidence and verve of Jared Kushner.
What's next in White House mayhem?
I think we banned a bunch more countries.
We did.
Oh, did we really?
Yeah. So we originally, if people will recall, we banned Libya, Iran, North Korea, Somalia, Syria, Venezuela, and Yemen. And
Chad, which was later removed.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about Chad later on. And, you know, you could, at least with that first group, you could be like, okay, I can make up a rationale. It's not a good one.
And they did. Several,
in fact. Bigoted. There's clearly some bigoted elements behind that, but like, sure. And eventually, after many, many iterations, the Trump administration did get court effective approval for the ban as it was implemented. But this new one is special. What did you learn, Radha?
We banned what seems to be a somewhat arbitrary list of countries. So it's Eritrea, Kyrgyzstan, Myanmar, Nigeria, Sudan and the Sudanese and Tanzanians are like travel ban light, where they're not eligible for the green card lottery anymore, but they can still come on certain other visas. And the sort of rationale, such as it exists, is that these countries lack the security and identity management protocols to meet U.S. screening requirements for immigration. that's particularly confusing in the context of places like Nigeria, which actually has a pretty high migration rate back and forth between the U.S., a relatively wealthy and highly educated population, and had been working relatively closely with the U.S. to improve their identity verification procedures to comply with new U.S. standards. So I think they were surprised to be included on this list. And yeah, that's not great.
It's also a little rich coming from the United States, which had allowed a reported Saudi member of Al-Qaeda to be living on an American Air Force base for a long period of time before he conducted a terrible shooting.
Well, luckily, we don't actually have anyone really officially in charge of any of the government agencies that run any of these programs.
That's a great point. Who was it that announced this policy, Radha?
Well, I think it was somebody performing the duties of somebody who could be in charge of CBP or ICE.
Yes.
Roughly?
Yes.
I think more precisely, there's been a lot of sort of shuffling the cards. What's that game you play where you try to hide the dice? Three Card Monty? Is that it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it's that with the Federal Vacancies Act. So they're like changing when they count the start date of when you're acting, or they stop letting you be acting and now you're an official performing the duties of. And they're basically changing the names or games of who is in charge. But at the end of the day, high-level political appointments in DHS writ large and at CBP and ICE in particular are still really lacking. And we have talked a lot about DOD turnover and vacancies, less so about DHS. But actually, these are the people that review, administer, and enforce all of these programs. And we don't really have political leadership and haven't for some time.
Well, we don't have confirmed political leadership, right?
That's
it seems
I mean,
as though we, the challenge here is that Department of Homeland Security, and whether it's Customs and Border Patrol or ICE, I think the assessment from the White House is that the folks they would like in those jobs are not confirmable or would have, you know, very significant political blowback in the Senate. Although apparently the Senate will just approve anything right now. So I don't know why they're so worried about that, to be honest. But that means that there are not Senate confirmed appointees in many of these roles. And there's no one really enforcing the Vacancies Act. So these other folks just kind of continue on and double dog dare Congress or the courts to say that they don't have the authorities that they say they have. So,
I mean, in fairness to the administration, I think they don't care about the rules. So I don't think they're like avoiding Senate. I just think like they're like, we have people, whatever. We don't care. We do what we want. Right. So I think there is a little bit of flaunting the rules more so than even political calculations, which I find, I don't know if more troubling, but troubling in a different way.
Oh, yeah. There's many ways to be troubled these days.
It's just a very inspiring part of the American dream is that you can start as an intern in the Department of Homeland Security and within 2 weeks be elevated to acting as the Secretary of Homeland Security.
Performing the duties of.
Sorry. Well, you can still be acting.
Fair.
You have to be performing the duties of later.
Ah, gotcha.
Very exciting. All right. There is yet still more mayhem to cover. Shall we do the NSC? And
yeah. Let's do the NSC. So and this shocks everybody. I know that I'm a little obsessed with the NSC staff. So a couple of things have gone on with regard to the NSC staff in the last week. Well, last couple of weeks. First, Robert O'Brien, National Security Advisor, has been moving out on his plan to shrink the size of the NSC staff to theoretically under 100 people, which I have done the math before. That doesn't really work out to an effective NSC staff. But let's leave that aside for a second. In parallel to this, there have been reports, now verified in some ways, of using this policy to push out people who are perceived as being not loyal to the president and just keeping in a more political NSC staff who are not the kind of bureaucratic operators that you might want to see in these positions. Namely, we've seen Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman and his brother both be marched out of the NSC staff on Friday after the president was acquitted by the Senate. So I'm of two minds about this. First, the president can have whatever NSC staff he wants, but there were ways to have gone about this that were not as kind of mob boss as he did. Like that Vindman had already planned to leave his detail early. It was supposed to be finished in the summer, but he had basically gone to DOD reportedly to say like, look, I'm not allowed to do any work right now. We should get me out of here sooner than later. But instead of just like allowing him to leave, they kind of made him pack up his things, force marched him out with his brother, and made a political play out of it, which was clearly meant to be threatening to other staff.
Right. I think that in some senses is the point, right? That it was that there are two separate but related issues happening here. And one is the president gets the NSC staff he wants, and that is pretty normal and standard and rotating people in and out in it with their agencies or military services, totally reasonable. Doing it in a way to demonstrate the power of the presidency and the role that that can play if you are, quote unquote, disloyal is a very different approach to the president gets the staff he wants. And I think that is more problematic than just, you know, transferring Vindman in and out per normal procedures.
Meanwhile, also Ambassador Sondland was recalled. And Ambassador Yovanovitch decided to retire. So there's all kinds of, I don't want to say musical chairs, but there's a number of pieces of fallout from people who provided detailed testimony in the House side of the impeachment hearings, because, of course, there were no witnesses called in the Senate side. And, you know, we're now seeing both how that affects their immediate political futures or professional futures, and see if we have this longer term chilling effect. I mean, on the one hand, yes, there's going to be a chilling effect. I mean, the president has shown that he's pretty willing to engage in retaliation, and I think believes that he'll be rewarded by his base for doing so. And there's not a lot of options for protecting folks otherwise, particularly at the White House staff level, right, at the moment. Ambassadors also serve at the pleasure of the president. There's not a lot that can be done in terms of recalling them. So an interesting set of arguments for potentially, there's many arguments for changes in presidential powers, but I think NSC staff appointments and ambassadorships are likely to remain in that column for quite some time. It'd be hard to revise that too thoroughly. So one of several troubling developments in the White House this week and every week. So that's great. any other mayhem, or can we move on to happier topics like pop culture?
Let's do some pop culture.
So the Oscars are going to be on later tonight, which means in the future, when you're all listening to this podcast, you'll know how wrong we are in any of the discussion that we have here. But I think one Oscar nominee that Lauren and I both saw this weekend was Little Women, in which, of course, I have to confess I have never read nor seen any of the adaptations for, and thought this one was delightful. So there's that.
I'm like so jealous. I really, 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 really want to see it. And shocking no one, I have read the book. And I'm always a little nervous about seeing actual adaptations about books I really liked, and especially books I loved like as a young girl. But I hear great things about this, so I'm very excited to see it at some point when I can.
So not only have Aaron not seen it, but like, do I have to say a spoiler alert here? I mean, the book was written in the 1800s.
Yeah, guys, read the book.
Spoiler alert. Aaron was not aware that Beth dies.
What? Aaron!
I don't read spoilers. You guys know this.
I know, but like that's like there's a Friends episode about this. Just to be clear. Like, this is in the, you know.
This is in the ecosystem.
I preserve the emotional impact of the film, and I think you should all be proud of me. I got to watch it as a newborn babe. It was delightful.
It was a really good adaptation.
We should also note that Greta Gerwig did not receive a director nomination for this. In fact, no women received director nominations for the Oscars this year, so they continue to do a bang-up job. Do you guys have any other Oscar-related movies that you're particularly excited about or are, you know, will be rooting for tonight?
No. No.
I saw Marriage Story.
You see a lot more.
It's fine.
You see many more movies than we do.
Yeah. I didn't see The Irishman. I'm not going to see The Irishman. If I have 3.5 hours in my life to see something, it will not be that. And I'm not rooting for it. How's that?
That's pretty good. I actually really liked Ford versus Ferrari.
I've heard that's better than it sounds from a movie named after two cars, which as a New Yorker, I'm like, meh.
It is. I will also say that I just discovered a new podcast, which is like all about books written by dead people. And it's by Marlon James, who wrote A History of Seven Killings, which is a Booker Award winner, one of my like favorite recent books. Not a book necessarily that you probably want to live in, to be honest, but he and his editor basically go through different books by all whose authors are dead and kind of have a sprawling, dishy conversation about all of these things. And so, Rhonda, you and delightful. Lauren would love this first episode, which talks about both like Jane Austen, but also Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers and kind of all of these things. And it's just like, I don't know, it's not a book you can live in, but if I could live in that podcast, I would kind of want to live in that podcast. So we'll include a link to that in the show notes. It's relatively new and it's just it's all fiction, folks. So sorry, they are not going through like Washington, you know, nonfiction reads for you, but it's fiction. It's delightful.
I am also really looking forward to the fashion and red carpet. So I will get to indulge in my continued princess/ball gown fantasies by looking at the beautiful dresses.
I think that's all we have for this week.
That's it.
See everyone in a couple of weeks. Thanks.